Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Yamilet Rodriguez, a 2019 recipient of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about her work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we're going to take you back a few generations to a time when African Americans first came to the San Joaquin Valley, looking for farm work and hoping to escape the shackles of racism. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We'll hear from several families whose ancestors migrated here before and during the Dust Bowl, but still face the kind of prejudice we tend to associate with the Deep South.
But first, the Green Book. The movie just won the Oscar for Best Picture, despite criticism for being whitewashed. But let's take a look at the real Green Book. It was a guidebook that steered African American travelers to safe places in the 1960s and even earlier. In the 1950s, Hank Hendricks was a teenager in Fresno getting ready for a family road trip to Arkansas.
My mom would cook everything before we left. And we put our water and food and everything. And that's the way we would travel.
And if they turned on the radio, they could have had their pick between a baseball game or radio drama, or a dose of reality.
Just the other day, one of the fine citizens of our community, Mrs. Rosa Parks, was arrested because she refused to give up her seat for a white passenger.
That's Martin Luther King Jr. in 1955. 2 years later, President Eisenhower would need to send federal troops to escort 9 children into a desegregated school in Arkansas.
This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock.
The Hendrickses left Arkansas during the Great Migration, eventually settling in Fresno in 1949. But visiting family in the South wasn't easy. On road trips, he, his parents, and his 4 siblings had to sleep in their car.
There was no such thing as accommodations along the highway. The only thing they wanted from African Americans at that time was money for some gas. Sometimes you couldn't even use restrooms at the gas station.
And restaurants? Forget about it.
I'm telling you, the restaurants, the gas stations, and any of those conveniences, they were absolutely not allowed to use them.
What his parents didn't know was there were guidebooks that listed diners, hotels, and car garages that welcomed African Americans. The biggest was the Negro Motorist Green Book.
They needed a green book and a lot more, truthfully. Those things would have made a heck of a lot of difference.
The Green Book was published almost every year from 1937 to 67. It included thousands of businesses, including 30 in the valley, mostly in West Fresno and Chinatown. So these were the locations that were in there. Doritha Williams and George Finley, both around 90 years old, remember almost all of them.
Buddy Lang.
Buddy Lane.
And Ruth's.
20th Century Tavern, Buddy Lane.
Oh, 20th, those are the Elks.
Yep, that was the Elks.
Many were Black-owned, but not all. Like the Fresno Hacienda, a motel and nightclub at Clinton and 99.
I remember Nat King Cole coming out there when they had the swimming pool. You could see the people swimming in the pool from the bar.
Finley was born in Alabama. When he moved to Fresno in the 50s, he thought he'd left Jim Crow attitudes behind.
It amazed me because thinking that if I came to the West, I would have full access to everything everybody else had, which wasn't true when I arrived here.
Despite having a teaching credential, it took him years to get a job in a school. Doritha Williams, a retired speech pathologist, grew up in Fresno. Her family had been run out of Mississippi, but the fear of violence remained, even in California.
Bakersfield
was
terrible.
Terrible, yes. Oradell, you wouldn't want to go to Oradell, even right now.
The Ku Klux Klan has been active in the valley. Claverns, as they were called, were founded as late as the 1930s in Visalia, Selma, and Taft. Neither Williams nor Finley knew of the Green Book, but by living here, it was obvious where they should and should not go.
You could not stop in Clovis.
At night.
You could not stop in Clovis in the daytime.
Travelers, though, that's who the Green Book was for. Candace E. Taylor is a documentarian putting together a book and museum exhibit on the Green Book. She says the worst were so-called sundown towns.
Some either rang a bell at 6 p.m. telling the domestics who were working in the town that they had to leave, or they would have a sign at the county line saying, N-word, don't let the sun go down on you here.
By some accounts, many Valley cities were sundown towns. Taylor says it was a matter of life and death.
You may be inconvenienced. That happened a lot. Humiliated, embarrassed, that happened a lot. But the reality was, you know, you could be not just harassed, but, you know, tortured and lynched and killed.
In just over 80 years, nearly 5,000 people were lynched in the U.S., mostly in the 1800s. But the last one was in 1964. The Green Book stopped being published just a few years later. Today, so many of these safe havens are gone, replaced by warehouses or highway on-ramps, or just big, empty lots, like this one in West Fresno, which Hank Hendricks tells me used to be a neighborhood called Jericho.
It's a desolated area. It's been abandoned.
Before, it was a bustling strip of black-owned bars and hotels. One restaurant was listed in the Green Book called New Jericho. Hendricks, who worked for the city and county and was a longtime school district trustee, says a developer demolished it all in the 70s.
Did the African-American community lose kind of a central place to gather?
In a lot of ways, yes. But from a political perspective, there was a political nucleus over here. They kind of splintered that, and they're all over the place now.
It's a story that still holds true today. Even as many doors have opened over the years for African Americans, he says, many remain closed. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Carrie, your story reveals a lot about what it was like to live and travel in the Valley before the Civil Rights Act. I'm curious, what did the Green Book even look like?
It was a little paperback with a green illustration on the front. The first few editions started pretty small, but by the 1960s, they had over 100 pages. They were organized by state, listing business names and addresses, and also ads and photos. Here's Candace E. Taylor, the documentarian you heard from in the story.
A lot of people say, oh, the Green Book was like a AAA for Black people, but it was so much more because it had drugstores and sanitarians and doctors and taxi service and anything you might need on the road. It was almost like a yellow pages of Black businesses. So you knew where you would be welcome. It was really indicative to understanding how many parts of society Black people were shut out of.
Over the three decades the Green Book was published, Taylor has cataloged close to 10,000 businesses from across the country. And she says the publisher, a Black New Yorker named Victor Hugo Green, used some really creative ways to find them.
It was everything from word of mouth, people saying, I know that I stayed here and it was fine, or they treated me well. A lot of the earlier editions in the Green Book are primarily the majority of the businesses listed were Black owned. So that was the first indicator. If you're a Black-owned business, you're going to serve Black people. But Victor Green was a postal worker. There was a Black alliance, a postal workers union alliance that Victor Green knew very well. And so he enlisted them. You know, it was a really genius idea because they were throughout the country. So he would tell them on their beat while they, because again, it was segregated that most of the Black postal workers served Black communities. So he would have them bring Green Books and, you know, approach the business owners with them. It was a win-win because the businesses could actually increase their business through tourism. And, you know, this was also during the second wave of the Great Migration. So there were during that second wave of the Great Migration, there were about 1.5 million Black people leaving the South, fleeing racial terror, heading north. So it helped those people who were leaving the South. It helped Black middle-class people who just wanted to have a vacation like anybody else.
So you said the book's final edition came out in 1967. As more civil rights laws got passed, was the Green Book no longer needed?
Taylor suspects that's part of it. Green himself also passed away in 1960. But Taylor says the story is much more complicated than that.
What I would speculate is, you know, once you got into the 60s, there was this idea that Brown versus Board had passed, so those white-owned businesses that wanted to serve Blacks were available. hotels especially started serving blacks, you know, they said, oh, well, we can go to the French Quarter now, and we never could. And so black people did. They stopped going to some of the Green Book sites and went to the French Quarter. And, you know, integration was a double-edged sword. In some ways, it was what black people really were fighting for and what, you know, a lot of Americans were fighting for, black and white. And yet it decimated these black-owned businesses because black people wanted to see what they had been shut out of and spent their dollars elsewhere. Black people could conceivably go to a white-owned drugstore and get their prescription filled. That was the hope. That wasn't always the reality, though. I mean, even after 1964, the Civil Rights Act, things didn't change, that drastically. And, you know, even in the later editions, the Green Book ran until 1967. And in the last two editions, there's all huge articles saying, you know your rights. These are your rights. These are the states that they're supposed to serve you in. And here's the recourse of what you can do if you're not served or treated fairly. So black people still had to fight to be treated, you know, as humans and as equals.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
When we think of California farm workers, the image that often comes to mind is that of Mexican or Central American workers. But years ago, many black families worked in the fields. In the 40s and 50s, African American families moved from states like Oklahoma and Mississippi to California's Central Valley, with the promise of jobs and an escape from the Jim Crow laws of the South. Alex Hall with member station KQED brings us the stories of two families whose dreams of getting ahead were shaped by the barriers they found right here in California.
There was a time when many people living in California's Central Valley could trace their roots directly to the American South.
This is Marilyn.
How are you?
Hi, Marilyn. Oh, my God. All you guys are so good.
The Marshall family came from Mississippi.
This is Brother Joe. Uh-huh.
Hi, how are you?
Are you a hugger, too?
Yeah. Lee and
we got dinner. Nothing but love for you.
Yeah.
Outside, a big storm is rolling in. Drops of water collect in pools around potted plants. A wind chime hangs just within earshot on the front porch. Joe, Lee, Marilyn, and Zella are four of 13 siblings, now all in their 60s and 70s. In a room next to the living room, a thin man lies in the fetal position on a bed. David Marshall has cancer. His brother, Lee Marshall, prays over his body as a TV set plays Family Feud.
Praise his holy name.
This is Lee. This is
God bless. God.
The walls surrounding the bed are covered in hundreds of framed family photos. There's a painted portrait of their mother. In fact, all of the rooms, including the living room and hallways, are a visual testament to the family's history.
This is my cousin. This is Joe and his first wife, right there. These are my grandkids here.
Zella Marshall is the oldest sister.
This is just some of the pictures. We still got a lot of them in boxes and stuff because we have no room to put them.
Zella and her sister Marilyn live here in South Dos Palos, a small farming community about 100 miles southeast of San Jose. Two of their brothers are here visiting today.
My name is Joe Marshall. And I was born in 1947. I bought my first home in Los Banos at 20 years old, and I've been in Los Banos ever since.
My name is Lee Marshall. I was born over in Merced, and we was raised on this piece of property. I was born in 1949. So as long as I've been living, this is where we come up at right here. Mm-hmm.
Joe and Lee's father moved to the Central Valley to work for the railroad, and in doing so, put distance between his family and the racist laws of the South.
You know, we could go anywhere and eat. It wasn't a place where you had to go to the back door. It was nothing like being in the South.
People in the South, they let you know right off the top, you not welcome, you not wanted, and hey, don't get out of place, you say mister to me. And they demand that you say yes, sir, and all this kind of stuff to them. It was just straight out. They didn't hide it. That was better for me because I know where you stand.
Even though we think of Jim Crow as being something Southern, the brothers say they found California had its own racism.
It's a hidden thing that they use on you.
The state allowed legal barriers that restricted where black families could live. Redlining prevented them from getting loans to buy houses, and there were sundown towns, places that people of color could visit during the day but had to leave by the time it got dark. In the 40s and 50s, Joe and Lee say South Dos Palos was thriving, but that racism shaped how the Marshalls lived and worked, and it shaped the destiny of their town.
Everything in South Dos Palos, except for a few places like behind us, was owned by black people.
There was a cafe on this corner. There was another one across the street over here. And then there was a service station.
For decades, cotton was one of California's top producing crops, just like in the South. To earn money, Joe and Lee worked in the fields.
I mean, anything from chopping beets with a short handle hoe, chopping cotton, picking grapes, cutting grapes, what they call it, knocking almonds out of a tree with the big rubber mallet.
Lettuce seeds, peaches,
apricots,
watermelons.
I mean, we've done everything that is out there to be done.
Growing up, Joe and Lee didn't have running water or indoor bathrooms in the house they lived in. That created awkward moments with their classmates.
It was kind of embarrassing to bring your girlfriend over. Hey, where's the restroom at? You better go outside. And that was hard.
Yeah. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, when the city put in the sewer line. And they say, but it's up to each house to dig, to hook up to it. Man, we were out there digging with a smile on. We were thinking, man, we gonna get indoor bathroom. Yeah. That was the happiest day of my life.
But if you go down that way, further down, they had all of this, and we didn't have it.
Just a few miles away from South Dos Palos was another community called Dos Palos, South Dos Palos without the South. There were a lot more white people in Dos Palos, and the homes there had indoor plumbing and running water.
We didn't see this hidden prejudice until we went downtown to school. It was prejudice.
Dos Palos is what Lee is talking about when he says downtown, in the place the brothers went to look for a job later on when they wanted one in town.
You out there waiting for a job interview, and behind closed doors, they just cutting you down. You're not wanted. I would take that more so than ever, this hidden prejudice, which still goes on today in these little towns like this. It's a hidden thing that can just tear you down.
There were a lot of towns in the Central Valley like Dos Palos and South Dos Palos, a black community and an all-white community just a few miles apart, existing side by side, separate but interdependent. When Latino farm workers began staying in the valley in greater numbers, instead of going back and forth to Mexico, they began changing this black-white dynamic. We're going to meet another family now, the Beavers, who saw this happen in their unincorporated town of Teveston, about 100 miles south of South Dos Palos on Highway 99. Around 60 years ago, Teveston was filled with black families living and working just outside a mostly white town called Pixley. Inside Friendship Baptist Church, the Reverend gives a sermon about letting go of hurt. And there is plenty of hurt to go around in Teveston.
Do you want to be healed?
Yes.
Bertha Mae Beavers, the matriarch of the Beavers family, sits in the crowd, hanging on the Reverend's every word.
I thought they was, you just come out here and you could pick money off trees the way they told it. But shoot, I should have stayed in Oklahoma. I did the same thing. Chop cotton, pick cotton. I did it all, you know. And it was rough out here, just like it was back in Oklahoma. You had to work hard for your money.
In 1946, Bertha Mae Beavers migrated here from Oklahoma at the age of 15. Soon after she arrived, a white woman was beat up on the railroad tracks nearby. Because of this, for a while, no black people were allowed in Pixley, she says. The rumor was that a black man from Teveston had beat the woman.
We would go to work, and we'd get off early and come home, and the men would get their guns and set up all night. And then they finally found out who beat the white lady up.
Turns out it was the white woman's husband.
He beat her up, and they tried to say the black man down here in Teveston beat her.
Bertha Mae was afraid, but she stayed. She eventually married her husband here. They had 12 children. The family lived on the outskirts of Pixley and worked in the fields to get by. Here are Bertha Mae's daughters, Annie, Ruth, and Mae Beavers.
Just in the house we lived in, we didn't have a two-bedroom, so with us, all of us 12 kids, we all slept in one bedroom.
It was just old and raggedy.
and we could lay in the bed at night, look out.
And see the stars.
Cracks and everything.
Like South Dos Palos, homes in Teveston didn't have running water, gas, or indoor plumbing. That would eventually change, along with a lot of other things. The 60s transformed California. In 1963, a state law was passed to end discrimination by property owners who refused to sell or rent to African Americans.
Congress passes the most sweeping civil rights bill ever to be written into the law.
In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was passed.
And thus reaffirms the conception of equality for all men that began with Lincoln and the Civil War 100 years ago. The Negro won his freedom then. He wins his dignity now.
The Beavers observed all of this at a distance. Until change came to them. Cesar Chavez and a growing movement of farm workers organizing for better pay and working conditions was gaining momentum in the Central Valley. While some black workers were involved, the movement was largely Chicano and Filipino. Ruth Beaver's husband, C.L. Jones, remembers witnessing the change.
So where it really started at was in the grapes.
Right.
They wanted to, you know, change things, and they did. You know, made things a lot better for some.
Eventually, residents fought to get a community well in Teveston. But some families distanced themselves from the upgrades, like gas in their homes. Again, Annie Beavers.
They're scared the white people might come and take their property or take their house. So they didn't really want no gas.
No.
And they knew. That's what you grew up with. Fear.
If you go to Teveston now, you'll see homes scattered throughout the town. Although, it's not much of a town. You don't see businesses, just a boarded-up gas station and two churches. Around the 70s and 80s, Bertha Mae's children were able to get out of farm labor and find new jobs. A few worked at nearby schools as lunch ladies and at the post office. Today, Latino families populate most of the houses. There are Latinos in leadership positions in the community.
We, as black people, I don't think fought as hard as we should have for what we wanted. You know, when you come from Oklahoma, you didn't really have nothing. So now you got a little something, you're scared. And they was raised that the white man takes everything. So they get out here and they just still scared of the white man. Just tell the truth about it. They were scared.
Right, there you go.
The white people.
The Beavers saw something in the Latino families moving into the area. Something that was new and completely unfamiliar. It was a certain boldness, a lack of fear that black families coming from the South felt they couldn't afford to have.
I'll tell you what we used to say when we was growing up. The white people are watching the wrong people. They was keeping us down and Hispanics were steady getting ahead. Steady getting ahead.
Teveston wasn't the only place where life was changing for black families in the Central Valley. Over in South Dos Palos, the Marshalls, the family we met earlier, also noticed a shift in the landscape.
Like I said, there was no jobs that the young blacks wanted to do. So when they got old enough, graduated high school, they started leaving here. The Mexicans were still working in the fields.
And they got the houses.
And all of a sudden, you started looking up. Mexican that brought this land, build a nice house, better than some of the houses that's been here.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an opportunity for them. our misfortune and their, you know, their fortune to come in and be able to buy something and build.
But it was okay with Joe Marshall because his kids were getting out and getting ahead.
You don't see any blacks out there now. You don't see any whites out there now. It's all Latinos because that's all they had to offer them, you know. And you want to cry that they're coming over here doing our jobs? No. They didn't take a job from me. I gave it to them.
Nowadays, the Marshall's house in South Dos Palos stands exposed on a desolate corner. It looks out onto an empty field.
And I saw this town kind of drying up to where when you come over, you could stop on every corner and holler at somebody and talk for a few minutes. I can come over here now. I might not see nobody, and I can ride all around town, not see anybody. Now it's a ghost town. And to this day, there's still no jobs here.
No
jobs. So you can't expect this town to grow.
Heavenly Father, we come to you today, Lord Jesus, just thanking you, Lord, one more time. Yes.
We thank you, Lord. It's the end of the day. The Marshall siblings stand in a circle holding hands and say a prayer. Even though their town has been disappearing for generations now, this land is still a gathering place for their family. Joe looks at his Latino neighbors and can relate to what they're going through. He knows nobody works in the fields if they don't have to, and the road out of this town is a long one.
That was Alex Hall from member station KQED. And now we're going to introduce you to some people whose families have been in the Valley for about a century. Moderator Kathleen Schock talks to two longtime Fresnans, Doritha Williams and Ann Lopez Gaston, about the obstacles their families faced and the hard work that allowed later generations to prosper. They're joined by historian Michael Eisinger.
So thank you all for being here. Just by way of introduction, I'm going to go around and introduce all the members of our conversation today, starting with Dr. Michael Eisinger. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And tell us a little bit about your work.
For the last almost 12 years, I've been researching the simple term I've come up with for it is historically rural African-American settlements. I know that's a big, long term to say that there have been in the history beginning in the 1880s and up through the 1960s at least two dozen all or majority black communities out on the landscape, whether it's colonies like Allensworth and Bowles or whether it's unincorporated towns like Fairmead and South Dos Palos or it's unincorporated neighborhoods like Home Acres or Sunny Home Gardens or Sunny Acres and this is the one that's the hardest to track down, and I'm sure I'm missing two-thirds of them, and that's black labor camps.
Great.
And they're all over the valley. So that's and then how these communities fare today and those types of things. That's Wonderful. What I've been working on.
Wonderful. Well, we'll get to all of that in just a minute. Also with us today are Doritha Cooley Williams. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
And also with us is Ann Lopez Gaston. Ann, tell us a little
Thank
bit
you.
About your family's story and how your family came to call the Central Valley home.
Well, it begins with migration coming in from either the Cape Verdes Islands or the Azores. The family, we would get stories from two sides, Azores or the Cape Verdes. They were islands that were Portuguese and African descendants. John Lopes, which was the Portuguese African, met a lady that was from Australia. She was mixed blood. They could not live in Australia, so they had to leave Australia, and that's when they took the ship and came over to America.
And then who was your first ancestor to live here in the Central Valley?
To my knowledge, it would be John Lopes, and I have a picture of him.
And one of her relatives lived across the street from me, and he resembled an Indian, long gray straight hair, and he was a horseman. His wife was a member of our church, which was right across the street.
So, Doritha, now that you've chimed in, tell us about your earliest ancestors to settle here in the Central Valley.
Oh, it was in the 20s.
And what brought them here?
They were from Mississippi. They had witnessed lynchings and so forth. But my dad's great aunt was the first one that I knew of. And she came because, and I've told them the story, she came because she had to flee for her life. She ran kind of a honky-tonk cafe in Mississippi, but the food was good, so a number of white patrons would come and eat. And my dad, who was 10 or younger, was there, and he was asked to dance. Well, he couldn't dance because his brother had put him in the fireplace, and three of his toes had burned when he was an infant. So he walked with a limp, but he was asked to dance. And he didn't say anything to this man. And the man said, "I told you to dance," and shot him in the very ankle of the foot, that left one. And when he did that, my great aunt, who always, you know, women wore those long aprons, she shot him.
What a phenomenal story.
We don't know to this day whether he lived or died because they had to leave right then. They were in Laurel, Mississippi, and they had to leave right then. Well, they went to Louisiana, I understand, and they stayed there for about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. But the word got out where they were, so then they came to California.
That is remarkable. So that migratory path from the South out to the West, Michael, can you speak a little bit to how common that was?
It's extremely common, and it comes in three different waves. The first one being in the 1880s during the Chinese exclusionary period, where they're trying to get rid of the Chinese and bring in other labor. When we look at our fields, we always just expect that whoever picks our crops is going to be probably undocumented and Hispanic. But we've had Japanese field crews, had Filipino film crew, work crews. There was a time when the most sought after was African Americans. At two different times and for two different reasons. So in the 1880s, 1884, Butler Farms here in Fresno is one of the two, one of the very first two, without being in Kern County, that are actually recruiting African Americans from the South. And they send back recruiters. They put in ads in newspapers all over the country. They bring back boxcars full of workers. They don't bring the 30,000 that they're looking for, but they bring back a significant number. The next big wave happens in the 1920s. And the majority of the families that I can locate today came here in the 1920s. In Fowler, the first four churches, two of them were African-American churches. South Dos Palos, the first black residents there were in the 1920s. Fairmead, the first black residents were in the 20s. So there was a wave that came in the 20s. And then the Dust Bowl in World War II and the immediate aftermath is the third big wave. And so during the Dust Bowl, you have the Black Okies. Every Black History Month, you'll see in the Bakersfield, California, in a Black Okie story. Mark Arax, who I work with a lot, always refers to all the Black migrants as Black Okies, even though it's not an accurate term, but it does lump it together in that period. And they are coming for the Dust Bowl. Then they come out to work in the shipyards and airplane factories and other factories in California in the urban areas. And at the end of the war, many of these families didn't want to go back to Mississippi or Arkansas or Texas or Oklahoma, where the Klan was ascended immediately after the war.
Plus, they couldn't get jobs.
And there weren't jobs. So many of these people that had come out here to work in the factories during the war pooled their money. And so Cooksyville, outside of Atwater, was a family compound of 150 people, bigger than Allensworth ever was and lasted longer, but there's no state park to it, right? Mm-hmm. The Williams family came into Fairmead and at one time owned the largest dairy in the state of California, the only black-owned dairy and the largest one in the state. Wow. And we see the same in Teveston and the Matheny Tract and all this, that that after the war, we have a lot of people who were rural people who came out to work in urban areas, and they didn't want to stay in Oakland or Baldwin Hills or some of those neighborhoods, and so they came here. And one of the reasons why so many of them ended up on the landscape was because at the time, it was very difficult for African Americans to get loans for property, mm-hmm. whether it's a home or a farm. Mm-hmm. And in most of these little towns that I write about, Fairmead, South Los Palos, Glenaire, Matheny Tract, Teveston, Alkali, there were white individuals who purchased large blocks of land and then sold them by carrying the contracts themselves. And there's some great stories with those. So that African Americans could purchase land in Lanier and in Fairmead, and that's how they got that's how they actually got property at a time when it was almost impossible for people to get that.
That's actually a story that I've had about my family because my father came out when he was 4 years old from St. Louis to Kalwa because he had a relative who owned land there, and they were able to live on that property. Mm-hmm. I was always sort of struck with what my ancestors must have gone through to be able to purchase land in the valley. I'm wondering, do you have, you're nodding your head.
Well, I know my great-grandmother, she left Jonesboro, Georgia.
Could be.
In the early, it would be the late 1800s, came by covered wagon. Her husband was already in Fresno. He was a blacksmith. And his name was Henry. So he had already had established a business. So he sent for her. And on that same covered wagon was Doritha's grandmother or aunts.
Aunt. Great aunt.
And then I think the Ellerts. The Ellerts, which would be Henry Ellert, the football player. His descendants, they were all in covered wagons, and they came out from Georgia to California. And I'm like, I'm trying to get in my mind, how did they do this? You know, that had to have been a horrific travel.
It's really a testament to their resiliency
And the conditions of the roads. And then also because of the color of their skin, there's no telling what they might have ran across, but they made it to California.
Yeah, there was no green book in the 1880s.
Yeah, you know, so I don't know what routes they took. But I just know that they came here by covered wagon. It was because my grandmother, which was her daughter at the time, was 5. And then her brother, Walter, was probably about 7. I think it was a couple, 2 or 3 years difference in their ages.
And what can you say about those early days for your family in the Central Valley? Was it an easy path for them to make their mark here?
Well, my great-grandmother, I heard a lot of stories about her, and she did live till I was about 12, so I got to see her in action. But she was a very, very, I guess, a trailblazer, pioneer-type woman. She was an entrepreneur. She actually had started businesses within the city of Fresno. They bought property out on, say, 99 Shields in that area. She had a big ranch out there. And I remember going out there as a kid, although she had moved into the city, but the property was still there. And the family sold it. And my great uncle, which was her youngest son, lived to be 100, almost 101. He used to tell me, Ann, every time I go down 99, I look over at Shields and McKinley, I cry because I know there's money on that property somewhere. Because she would bury money.
Oh, my heavens.
You know, she would bury money.
You guys need to take the guy and go out there.
And I told Rick, I said, whoever bought that property probably came across a lot of money because she didn't believe in banks.
Yeah.
You know,
they did not believe in banks.
And sometimes I told Rick, I said, you know, that's not a bad idea to just take stuff and bury, but you have to have someone.
You have to remember where it's at.
But,
so, Doritha, tell us a little bit about your experience, your family's experiences when they first came out here.
Well, the only thing I know is that this aunt, this great aunt, and her husband bought land, and then they bought land. And then they bought land. Now, when they came, the only thing available for him was yard work. And so he took a lot of young boys and amassed money. And my great aunt saved, I don't know, she had about a quarter of a block of land, corner land, that's there today. And she grew everything that they ate. She grew everything, chickens, a few ducks, but all of the vegetables, you know, and she lived that way. Her nephew, my dad, and his two brothers, the two brothers had fought in the war. William, the oldest one that put him, my dad, in the fireplace, had lived after the war and had come to California to be with aunt because Doritha, after my dad's sister, and his mother and father all died of tuberculosis.
Oh, goodness. Mm.
And my dad had tuberculosis when he was a young man, and they put him in a lean-to outside of the house, and that's where he slept and stayed. And they brought food to him, and it was like chicken mesh or whatever you call that.
Chicken
mesh. Right. On the sides to keep animals from coming in, but he stayed there until he was cured.
So my family in Kiowa lived in what was essentially a tent for most of my father's childhood. He lived there with his six siblings and worked in the fields, of course, while also going to school. I'm understanding, as I look at the history, that those kind of conditions were actually fairly common for African Americans living in the Valley at that time.
Oh, yes, except that, remember, we couldn't put our money in the bank, so our money was always readily available to us. My aunt would have been hung had they not had enough money to leave immediately after she shopped the gym.
Michael, can you speak a little bit to the conditions within the camps?
Yeah, and it doesn't change between the 1880s and the 1960s. Essentially, they are pretty primitive. The work camps, especially, if there are, I mean, you can still see a few remnants along the sides of some of the county roads of these just small little shacks. If you haven't had a chance, up until last month at the Fresno Art Museum, and it's now on exhibit up at UC Merced, there are the photographs of Ernest Lowe, who came through in 1961, 62, and 64, and took amazing photographs in a number of communities. The total collection is over 10,000 photographs of African Americans working the fields of the Central Valley. He also has a similar collection of Hispanics and of Filipinos and White Okies doing the same thing. But this is 1961 through 64, and yet the photographs that he produced, you couldn't tell if they were from Dorothea Lange's period in the 30s or whether they were from the 1870s, because these are tar paper shacks. Many cases I know people have interviewed in Fairmead and the Delano labor camp, they were in tents. They were in wooden frames with literally nothing but tar paper and maybe some wood over it. Very, very primitive. There were still, in the 80s and 90s, there were still African-Americans out in the Tulare Lake Basin who had neither running water nor electricity. You get out of the cities, the rural poverty among the African-American community is all over the place. And, just go to Teveston and drive around. Half of those buildings you think are abandoned, there are people still living in them. Mm-hmm. I often put up I'll start my talk this way out. I'm speaking on the 28th, I think it is, up at Merced College. And I always start the talk off with a picture of these people standing in a field. And I go, where is this? And they say Mississippi. And I say Madera. And then everybody's freaked out because the next picture I ask the same question. And they go, and it was Pixley. So it's, I think we can get into a whole heavy discussion about how we make the memory fit our present. And so forgetting that blacks are in the field, we're in the fields for essentially almost 80 years. picking cotton, which was one of the primary crops of the valley, that does make us look like and feel like Mississippi. And when you look at these conditions, the incongruity in most people's brains when you show them how these people were living within our within my lifetime, within all of our lifetimes, living in these conditions, some of them still there, it doesn't register. How can that be? That's the Deep South. That's not California. That's not this progressive place that we love so much.
But we have to understand, this is an agricultural valley, and the entire valley.
And,
people who come because they want to work and make money. Many of the Hispanics would send their money back to Mexico, back to Cuba, back to wherever, because what a lot of people fail to realize is that Hispaniola was everything between South America and North America.
You mean Nueva España?
Yes.
Yeah, New Spain, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, but I ask my students what happened here in 1775, and they start telling me about stuff that happened in Concord and Boston. I'm saying, no, what happened here in 1775? Because it doesn't dawn on them that because we don't study Spanish history or Mexican history,
that's
and yet
right.
that's the history
that's
of where
right.
we live. And
but
so this history is also just, we just ignore it.
Well, Fresno, I have to give Fresno credit. My parents taught black history when they taught adult education, and most of the Italians and a few German, but most Italians were the ones whom they taught. In fact, at my mother's funeral, there were more Italians than there were blacks.
Well, but I want to get back to the point you made about agriculture really being the defining thing that brought people to this region.
Right.
And it was so many of the stories that I've been able to go back and read have been stories of blacks in the South who were working as sharecroppers, who saw this region of California as a place to leverage their skills and experience in a way that will allow them to break the bondage of sharecropping. I'm wondering if have you been able to find those stories in your research, Michael?
There are a bunch of them. Mark Arax writes about a guy named Robert Parker. Robert Parker was one of probably about a dozen, I guess we call them transporters. He made 40 trips between here and North Texas and Oklahoma, rounding up people who wanted to abandon their sharecrops. He worked for a guy, a labor recruiter, who had a brother who was a sheriff back in Oklahoma. And the sheriff would go around to the sharecroppers and say, look, if you want to get out of this mess, because what people understand with the sharecrop is that when great-grandfather got on the land, he didn't have any money, so he borrowed money from the landowner to get the seed and the plow and all that stuff. Then he paid his share plus what of the debt he could was probably more than he made. And so then the debt would continue and it would accrue each
That's
and every
right.
year.
It was
until
another form of slavery.
Exactly. And it was cheaper for them than slavery was. And so by the time we get to the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, there are a lot of people that want to get away from it. And there's no computerized databases, no, Better Business Bureau in the level that we think of today. And so if you could get, like you're the one who shot somebody, wanted to get away from
had to get away.
You had to get away. You could do this. And so he would go around and he would, on prearranged times, and he would pick people up under bridges and on the sides of fields. And he was just one of many. And they brought, he made 40 trips. He had a school bus. Bought an old school bus, and that's what he used. And there were others that used flatbeds with benches on the back, so people would make the trip from Mississippi riding in an open flatbed the whole way just to get here. So it isn't just covered wagons that made it difficult. Many of the people that came under the most insane conditions, but they got here. And initially, they came for free, and they were essentially indentured servants. And so in
That's
the 1880s, 1890s, there were white guys on horses riding around the valley looking for runaway blacks. I mean,
That's
you
right.
can't get any more southern
That's
than
right.
than looking wow. for people who ran away.
That's
Within
right.
a few years, they decided it was easier, because what happened was they were offering 50% of the pay that they were offering whites and that the Chinese had been getting when they're trying to get rid of the Chinese and bring these black workers in. And so people would come out here and they would realize they were getting ripped off. And most of the people, what people don't understand is slaves had skills. There were some, I mean, even picking cotton is a skilled labor.
But, that's right.
But many slaves worked in construction. They worked in packing houses and not packing houses, but the plantation version of it. They could mm-hmm. process meat. They could butcher. They could, mm-hmm. could. So they had lots and lots of skills. And so they would come out here, and when they were essentially owing the company the transportation, they were essentially indentured servants. So the first blacks that came out at that point really kind of were just trading one kind of slavery for another. Then they decided it was cheaper just to charge them. It was easier. That way, if they got out here and decided they didn't want to work for the labor recruiter, they could find work elsewhere. They could. But many of the stories that you hear, whether it's the Delano or the Stratford or Strathmore or the many of these labor camps, there were six of them outside of Pixley. You know, the conditions are horrible. They came in these large numbers, and they're a huge part of our history that just doesn't exist until people like the four of us start screaming about it and going, hey, they're here.
Mm-hmm. Which really leads me to, and I wish we had more time. I could talk about this forever. But before we wrap up, I would love to hear from all of you about why this history matters. I mean, these are conversations that are not largely had in schools in the Valley or among groups outside of the African American community. And Anne, we'll start with you. Why is it important to hold on to these stories? What does it mean to people today?
If you have no history, then you cannot go forward. Like going back to my forefathers that came here, and then my great-grandmother, she actually had a business where she had a boarding house, and then she also had a sanitation business. And my dad, his brother and cousin, they ran the trucks. So it's like they were in high school, but they were driving trucks for her. Eventually, she lost the business, and it went to the Gabriel family, and then from the Gabriel family went to BFI.
But that's a proud history to pass down to the next generation. It's important to know that there's so many stories of success.
And then my Ed Lopes was the one that we were talking about earlier. He worked with Mr. Fancher, Senior Fancher of the Underground Gardens.
Yes.
I was told, and nothing's written down, that he actually helped build that underground garden with old man Fancher. Nothing's written, so it's like history could call it maybe folklore, but you can pass that on. And it gives our kids a sign of stability that they can be. You can do whatever you want once you put your mind forward, no matter what the circumstances are. And when I see what they had to go through and what I might be going through now, I'm just like a chip off the old block, because they set it. You know, they set the pace.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah, the contributions of blacks in the Valley were so instrumental to creating this community. Mm-hmm. Doretha, why do you think this history matters?
Oh, I know it matters. Because you have to have some stimulus to let you know you can get over. Blacks have come a long way. We have a lot to do yet, but we've come a long way, a long, long way. And knowing your history gives you the impetus to do it yourself.
Well, I can't think of a... It's a perfect way to end this conversation. We certainly have seen a lot of growth in this region, and it's. I really appreciate you all taking the time to really document the incredible contributions that African Americans have made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Carrie Klein, and reporters Monica Velez and Laura Satsui. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Yamilet Rodriguez, a 2019 recipient of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about her work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.